This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A couple of years ago, in the doldrums of winter, one Vermont family made an interesting decision. The family members, parents and two young children, would live without any added sugar for an entire year. That meant no candy, no cakes, no soda, of course. But it also meant no store-bought tomato sauce or bread or ketchup, among the many products on grocery store shelves with added sugar and sugar substitutes. The journey began when Eve Schaub and her husband watched a YouTube video of a lecture by Robert Lustig, a pediatric endocrinologist at the University of California, San Francisco.
High fructose corn syrup and sucrose are exactly the same. They're both equally bad. Okay? They're both dangerous. They're both poison. Okay? I said it. Poison. My charge before the end of tonight is to demonstrate that fructose is a poison, and I will do it. And you will tell me if I was successful.
Robert Lustig was certainly successful in convincing Eve Schaub. After her family's sugar-free adventure, she wrote a book about it called, appropriately, Year of No Sugar. We're going to talk about what it's like to try to eliminate or at least reduce sugar from your life with Eve Schaub today. Welcome to the program.
Hi there.
We're also joined today by Rachel Johnson, chair of the American Heart Association's Nutrition Committee and a nutrition professor at the University of Vermont. Rachel Johnson, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Jane.
Eve Schaub, you admit that you and your family already ate pretty well before you heard that talk by Robert Lustig, and you were healthy. So what about that statement that fructose is poison resonated with you?
Well, I'm so glad you played that clip, because Dr. Lustig is such a powerful speaker, and I hope that lots of people who are more curious to find out will go and seek out that YouTube video. We were relatively healthy, you know. I always considered myself to be a person who was interested in food, and I thought that I read labels. I thought I knew what was in my food. But after watching this video, it was as if a veil had been lifted from my eyes, and everywhere I went, you know, everywhere we go, there's food. And everywhere we go in our culture where there's food, there's sugar. And I started finding it in all kinds of crazy places. And that's when I realized I had to do something.
Rachel Johnson, I want to hear your perspective on this, too. Do you think of fructose as poison? I mean, what do you think when you hear that clip from Robert Lustig?
Right. Well, I know Rob Lustig personally. He's a colleague, and he certainly knows how to get headlines when he calls fructose poison or a toxin. I don't think I'm quite that inflammatory about it. I think of a poison or a toxin in a food as something like a foodborne illness, if you have Listeria or E. coli H157. And certainly in very, very, you know, high amounts, sugar can be dangerous. And we certainly are calling for some serious moderation in American sugar intake.
Can you explain some things before we go too far down this road, just so that we all understand, because it is confusing, at least to me, the difference between glucose, sucrose, fructose, and then we have, you know, lactose, all of these different OSes. Can you explain them so that we understand what the heck sugar is and what we're talking about when we say sugar?
Sure. When something ends in the letters O-S-E, it's a sugar. Sucrose, dextrose, fructose, maltose, they're all sugars. We distinguish them between added sugars, which are the sugars that are added in processing or preparation of mainly processed foods, from naturally occurring sugars like fructose in fruit and lactose in dairy products. When we're talking about reducing added sugars intake, we're not talking about reducing your fruit or your milk and dairy intake.
And does it all act the same in your body?
It all acts the same, but you have to think of how those sugars are carried. So fructose, naturally occurring in fruit, comes with a lot of fiber. So that slows the release of the fructose into your body, as opposed to just having the fructose not being carried in fruit.
But if I eliminated all of whatever the product was that it came from and just took a sip of pure whatever OS, it's all going to act the same once it's in my bloodstream?
Yes,
or
more
in
or
my
less.
Digestive system?
We know that fructose acts slightly differently than glucose or or other sugars in the way that it's metabolized in the liver, but essentially all sugars are metabolized similarly and they all have 4 calories per gram or 16 calories per teaspoon.
And Eve Schaub, how did you determine what your family was going to eat? Because you didn't eliminate all fruits, for example, from your diet.
No, not at all. It is very confusing because there are simple sugars, there's blood sugar, there's sugar. The term sugar comes up in so many different ways. What we did was we understood that sucrose, which is sugar, table sugar, you know, is broken up into roughly 50% glucose, 50% fructose. So what we were avoiding was specifically extracted fructose, which is added sugar. So we could eat an apple, but we could not have a glass of apple juice. That was extracted fructose. So it was removed from its original source of fiber and micronutrients.
We're talking today about how much sugar is in our modern diet and all of the various places that you can find it on your grocery store shelves, bread, hot sauce, soup, you name it, there's probably sugar in it. And we're getting a nutritionist perspective as well as hearing one family's story about what it's like to try to live without any added sugar for a full year. Listeners, if you have a story to tell or a question for our guests, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can add to the conversation that's already been started on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We got a note from Anne who asks, does no added sugar include the sugars in maple syrup, honey, agave, and other natural syrups? Eve, what about for your family's experiment? What was included?
I'm afraid so. And that's tough because, you know, we live in Vermont. You know, we had to be like, shh, don't tell anyone. Maple syrup's also off the table, you know. But in fact, all of these are extracted forms of fructose. So in maple syrup, you've got the boiling down extraction process. Honey was off the table because the bees are already doing the extracting process for you. You know, all of these things. Agave is actually higher in fructose than average sugar. It can be up to 80 or 90% fructose instead of around 50. So all of these things were off the table for us, yes.
Rachel Johnson, what about for you? If somebody is trying to reduce their sugar intake, does having something like maple syrup make it better than having table sugar or some
kind
of...
Well, she's correct. They're all added sugars. So I would agree. What I like to say is, well, the American Heart Association, we recommend that most women should have about 6 teaspoons or 100 calories a day of added sugars. For men, it's 9 teaspoons or 150 calories a day. So what I like to say is use that little bit of sugar to sweeten or enhance the flavor of already nutritious foods. So use that little bit of maple syrup on your oatmeal in the morning to help sweeten it a bit. So we're not saying, you know, completely eliminate added sugars. Just use them. Just limit the intake.
Is there any benefit to having honey or maple syrup instead of something that's been processed? I mean, maybe even just beyond the actual sugar content, is there a benefit? Because people want to think there is, at least.
I think it's mostly taste and preference. There's a small amount of trace minerals in some sugars like molasses, but the amount is so small that it's almost negligible.
And I just wanted to point out, Jane, that the book that I wrote, A Year of No Sugar, I wanted to tell the stories of what it was like to go to the extreme. But the book was not attempting to tell everyone that we're supposed to eradicate sugar from the face of the earth. Far from it. I simply wanted to begin the conversation about the saturation of our food supply and say, this is far worse than we really think.
Well, and for you and your family, you are no longer in that year of no sugar.
That's
so
right.
You have added some sugar back, but I suppose going to the opposite extreme and then finding a happy medium must have allowed your family to figure out a little bit better what you want to consume.
Exactly. And one of the most interesting things that happened during our year was that we found our palates changed over time. We had a rule that we could have one sugar-containing treat per month. So if it was your birthday that month, you got to pick the treat. And at first, we really looked forward to these treats. And then as time went on, we looked forward to them less and less, to the point when we got to the fall time, and we'd been doing this for several months, we found that we didn't enjoy them at all. In fact, I got a pounding headache. I had to go brush my teeth. Our palates were now tuned to such much more subtle levels of sweetness. So we would find something like a sweet mashed sweet potato or a really ripe banana as being just perfectly sweet. And then a hot fudge sundae would be like, ugh, disgusting.
We got notes on similar lines from some of our listeners. Maggie in Brattleboro says, I avoided both flour and sugar for a year. I didn't miss it. I had lots of energy and I generally felt great. I craved different foods. Going to a vegetable stand, I would come out with bags and bags of kale, chard, and other vegetables. And fruit really was like dessert. As soon as I ate one thing with sugar, I started wanting bread and sugar again, a little bit, and then more and more, and I felt hungrier too. Please, medical community, Maggie says, don't tell me that sugar is not addictive. And Jackie says, sugar doesn't make me feel good, except for the few short minutes it's running past my taste buds. It also feeds the yeast in my body. That does not make me feel good. That said, those taste buds seem to have a lot of influence for the small amount of square inches they occupy. Slow weaning and continued vigilance, in my experience, is working. And working hard at eliminating it completely from my diet is still going on and on. So, Rachel Johnson, what about that idea that, you know, the way you get accustomed to sugar in your diet, and, you know, Eve is talking about her palate changing when she eliminated that sugar from her diet. Can you explain a little bit about how that works?
Well, I think she's absolutely right that we can retrain our taste buds. There's actually a lot more literature about sodium and salt preferences than there is in the sugar area, but we know when people start cutting back on sodium, they get much more accustomed to a less salty taste, so that when they have something that's very salty, they just can't even believe that they used to eat it. So I think the same can be true with sugars and just getting yourself accustomed to that less sweet taste. I know, for example, children's yogurts, many of them are so highly sweetened that when you taste them, you just, you know, can't even believe how sweet they are. And I have a good friend who's a dietitian and has young children, and she, you know, cuts the yogurts in half. She'll use a plain unsweetened yogurt and mix it half and half, or sweeten it themselves, so that she's not training her children to have that very sweet taste.
So when our listener Maggie wrote and said she feels like sugar is addictive, is that right in a scientific sense, or is it just in that way your brain becomes accustomed to it?
I don't think we fully know the answer to that yet. There's some good animal studies that have shown that sugar can have the properties of addiction. And so there's certainly some evidence in these animal models that it may have an addictive nature. That doesn't mean that we can't change our patterns, that we can't, you know, that we can't eat healthier.
I will say that in some ways it's easier to go without, because moderation is such a difficult thing to define, you know, and I think you get the slippery slope effect of, oh, well, I'll just have a little here and, oh, maybe a little more there and, oh, whoa, you know, out of control. So it's actually, there were some ways that I found that our year of no sugar was easier because we had such specific, you know, parameters. Whereas once we got to the end of our year, we found like, whoa, no more rules. What's okay? And we had to sort of start all over again and redefine it for ourselves.
Eve, what was the trickiest thing to find on the grocery store shelves that didn't have any sugar, or make yourself? I mean, what were some of the things that you found?
Oh, bread. Bread is a tough one. I mean, we're very lucky because in the next town over, we have a fellow who makes a wonderful bread, and he uses four ingredients, and none of them is sugar. So we, you know, whenever we could, we would get our bread from him. We go to the supermarket. They have like 250 different varieties of bread, and there's only one sandwich bread that we could buy that didn't have any added sugar. Now, that's not to say that there isn't, you know, 400 other ingredients in this bread, but that was a real frustrating thing for me. So I started baking a lot of my own bread at home.
What was the toughest for your kids?
Oh, gosh. I think socially. You know, whenever we were at home, they talked about how once we got used to it, they were totally like, no problem, this, we can do this. And we put berries on our oatmeal, and we put bananas on our pancakes, and, you know, maybe we have some fruit for dessert at night, you know. But when we'd go out in the world and, you know, they'd be at school and, you know, kids can be very unkind, and I'm having ice cream for dessert, too bad you can't, you know, because of course all the kids knew about our project. They, you know, the kids had talked about it. Or we'd go to a party and, you know, everybody's licking ice cream, or at fundraisers, all these social essential things. So that's something I'm hoping to sort of raise awareness about, is that we've got this sort of sugar inflation going on in our society. And it would be helpful to sort of bring it back a couple notches.
Well, and I think you said you told your kids, look, when you're out of the house, it's up to you. You can make the decision about what you want to eat.
We called it the birthday party rule. If you guys are at some something away from home and everybody around you is having a particular thing, it's up to you whether to have it or not. And sometimes they chose to have it, and sometimes they didn't. And that was what really impressed me. But they always, the condition was, you always got to come tell me about it. Whatever it is, I want to know, because it's all part of our family project research for the blog and the book.
And you think they did?
Yeah.
There was no sneaking
I do.
Halloween treats.
I said no guilt, no repercussions, and I really feel that they did come and tell me everything, because sometimes they were a little sheepish, you know, and, oh, this happened at school, everybody had hot chocolate, and yes, I did have some. And I would say, no, this is good, because I need to know. I was astounded at the amount of sugar. I had no idea as a parent how much sugar gets thrown at my kids when they're not with me.
Wow, we're talking about sugar today. We're learning a little bit about where you can find sugar, or perhaps more exclusively where you can't find sugar in the foods that we eat these days, and what it's like to try to take sugar out of your diet for a whole year. We'd love to hear from you, listeners, if you have questions or maybe you have some experiences along this line yourself. You can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call us 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Rachel Johnson is a nutrition professor at the University of Vermont. Eve Schaub is the author of Year of No Sugar. Together, they're sharing perspectives on sugar and how pervasive it is in our food stream. If you've tried giving up or cutting back on sugar, tell us a story about what you've found challenging. What was the most surprising food you've found added sweeteners in? And what do you want to know from a nutritionist's perspective on how to safely and sensibly reduce your sugar intake? You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We got a question from Whitney, who has a very practical question here, and I'd love for both of you to offer some suggestions. Whitney says, could you please provide some sort of example grocery list? Because trying to figure out what has sugar and what doesn't these days is virtually a full-time job. Eve, you first, because you spend a lot of time with this.
Yes, it's interesting because people ask me what was the hardest part of doing a year of no sugar. And I always say, well, at first, the hardest part was the recon, you know, going to the store and bringing my microscope, you know, and my magnifying glass and my dictionary and trying to figure out all these teeny tiny type, crazy words. And that can be the hardest part. But once we got a handle on that, there are more than 50 different terms for sugar. And so it can be in several different places in a product, not just one. But once we got the hang of it, I would always go back and say, okay, I know this is the tomato sauce I can buy. This is the one bread I can buy. And things got easier right away.
What do you think, Professor Johnson?
I would give the age-old advice to shop the perimeter of the grocery store, where most of the whole, what I think of as real unprocessed foods are. So the more you're getting into the aisles in the grocery store where you're having a lot of processed foods, you're going to be finding a lot of added sugars.
But realistically, how difficult is this for families? I mean, not everybody has the time and the resources to be able to do this kind of shopping, to be able to be making more of their own food. I mean, certainly you can shop the perimeters, but you then also may still need to be cooking more. And, you know,
not every family is going to make their own crackers, for example, you know.
Right. And so, Eve, you've done this. And Professor Johnson, I see you looking at me like, oh, come on, Jane, anybody can do this. So, Eve, you did it. But how much time did it take?
Well, I have to admit, I've always loved to cook. I've always loved to bake. And so, you know, that was a big part of our year. But I understand that there are plenty of people out there who either don't have the inclination or they don't have the time. It's definitely possible. But like I said, it's going to take a little bit more looking. You're going to need to be really tenacious about always, always reading your ingredients. You know, but if you go to my website, which is yearofnosugar.com, I have a very short little slideshow of different products that we found were great go-tos. You know, every time, you know, if I don't have time to make my own tomato sauce, I knew I could always buy this one. If, you know, I never have made my own crackers, I always bought Triscuits, you know, plain Triscuits. Anything with lots of flavors, chips, you know, dressings and gravies. Whenever you get into something with lots of different added flavors, you know, that's when you know you beep, 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 you need, your alarm needs to go off and you need to really read.
Professor Johnson, I want to hear what you were thinking when I said, you know, cooking and, yeah. and perimeters.
Well, I was just thinking that in order to eat a healthy diet, you almost have to cook. And I think there's a resurgence of interest in cooking. At the University of Vermont, we offer several classes. One is called Environmental Cooking. They fill within minutes of them coming online during registration. There's such demand from our students to learn how to cook, to really learn about food and learn how to cook. So, you know, when people say, well, I don't have time, I think it's about priorities and how you choose to spend your time.
I agree entirely. I write in the book about how I'm like, what could be more important than the food that we're putting on the table for our families to eat? I mean, I know that people are short on time, but at the same time, I do think it's a matter of making it a priority.
So you don't think this is an upper middle class preoccupation? I mean, you say what could be more important, and I'm sure every parent and every person would agree. And then there would be people who say, I work two jobs. I don't have time to cook. And why can't I find something on the grocery store shelves that is healthy for my family?
Well, we should be able to. And that's something that I come back to a lot is food shouldn't be this hard, you know. And that's something that I'm hoping that the more people that are demanding more clear ingredients, more simpler foods, that we're going to see more of that. Foods that don't have added sugar necessarily, that really shouldn't have it because they're not sweet. You know, why can't I find a mayonnaise or a salad dressing or a soup broth, you know, chicken broth, beef broth without added sugar? That's silly. You know, I shouldn't have to always make my own chicken broth every time I want it. But I also think there's the issue of, well, you can pay now or you pay later. You know, you can pay attention, you can make your own food, or you deal with the health repercussions down the road, whether it's heart disease, obesity, metabolic syndrome, diabetes. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about the kind of poison where you take one bite and you keel over dead. We're talking about, it's like cigarettes. You can have a cigarette today and tomorrow and next week, and you're fine. But a couple decades of that, and you're going to suffer in a big way. And it's very dramatic.
Let's go to Mark, who's calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I just have been listening to the show, enjoying it, and I have a couple of thoughts on this. You know, knowledge is experience with things. You know, knowledge in a book is a lot different than action, getting involved. So this is the thought on food. To have kids in school, a public school system, you could experiment with it in one place and see if it worked. But you could you'd have a seed and soil. Everybody gets into the field, and in the winter time you have a greenhouse. Forget the money part. There's plenty of money in education, but get kids right into food, the very thing that sustains us right from the beginning. And then in the computer, you'd have the databases of all the great cuisines of history. You could study it, and you could do all your own cooking in-house. And everybody coming out of school at age 16 or 17 would know how to prepare food. They'd be thinking about food all the time. And I think that's what would change eating habits and get people more critical of, you know, all the label reading in stores is enough to make your head spin.
Yeah, Mark, I hear what you're saying. And Professor Johnson, I mean, we've done interviews on this program about schools in Vermont that are working on exactly what Mark is talking about, starting with a garden, teaching kids about food, seeing it in their school lunches. Are you seeing that kind of education incorporated into the curriculum at all?
Absolutely. I think it's an exciting time to be in schools now. The American Heart Association has a teaching garden program, and our goal is to have 500 teaching gardens around the country, and we're about halfway there. So there is a real excitement around this. And I think that if you haven't been in a school recently, there have been a lot of changes in school nutrition. Children are now required to take a fruit or vegetable with their lunch this coming school year. There's going to be new regulations on what we call competitive foods, which are those banks of vending machines that we used to see in schools outside of cafeterias. The caller's absolutely right, but it's an exciting time, and we're seeing a lot of changes around nutrition in schools.
And let's go to Mike, who's on the line with us from Newfane. Hey, Mike, go ahead.
Yes, I wish you would just spend more time telling the audience why sugar is bad. We hear a lot about that, well, we should really be changing our habits so that we could be better, more healthy, and so on. But I know there's a tremendous amount of scientific medical evidence around the health issues. Could we spend a little more time talking about that? Thank you.
Yeah, Mike, thanks for the call. I'll ask both of you to comment on this, but Professor Johnson, maybe you could go first. Why is sugar so bad? We need it.
Right. Well, briefly, sugar's bad. We know high intakes of added sugars, especially sugar-sweetened beverages, so especially in the form of beverages, are associated with overweight and obesity, which is a risk factor for heart disease, type 2 diabetes, some cancers. We also know that it's linked with other risk factors associated with heart disease, like high blood pressure, like high triglycerides, like chronic inflammation. So there's a lot of science linking high intakes of added sugars with a number of risk factors for serious chronic disease.
But let's say I was a person who could consume 3,000 calories a day because I was running a lot. And, I got enough vitamins, but I got a lot of my calories from sugar. Would I still be at risk of those things that you're talking about, or is it more the amount of calories that we're getting?
Well, that's a great analogy, because the recommendations that we make, I always say, are for the average American woman or the average American man who isn't as active or expending 3,000 calories a day. But you take the Michael Phelps of the world who, when they're in training, might be needing up to 8,000 or 10,000 calories a day. And of course, there's room for some sugars in their diet. And so it's this fine-tuning your energy expenditure, which is largely determined by your physical activity patterns, with your intake.
So part of it is that we've substituted some lower-calorie foods for higher-calorie foods, and those calories are coming from sugar? Is that part of the problem?
Right. Some of it is that our activity levels are so low, that our energy needs are so low, that we just don't have room in our diets to meet all of our essential nutrient needs and have a lot of extra, what I call empty calories left over.
Eva, I want to get to you, but let me just ask one more question of Professor Johnson on this thread. So if somebody is looking at something in a grocery store and they have the choice between something that is low in fat but high in sugar or higher in fat, how do they make that determination of what a better product to go for is?
That's a really good question. We made a big mistake in the 90s when we pushed low fat, low fat, low fat. But then what happened was the food industry responded by making all of these low fat, high sugar products. So if you look at a lot of the fat-free salad dressings, like Eve said, one of the first ingredients will be high fructose corn syrup. So what we want to do is have healthy fats, emphasize those monounsaturated fats like olive oil and avocados, choose your healthy fats and choose your healthy carbohydrates, your whole grains, your oatmeal, your whole wheat flour, choosing whole grains instead of sugars. So it's about the quality of the calories rather than, specifically what to avoid.
Eve Schaub, jump in here.
Another thing that I wanted to point out is that with fat, you take it into your body and it registers. You feel satisfied. You know, a small amount of fat can go a long way. Whereas with sugar, you take it in and it doesn't register. Your body doesn't need it. It goes straight to your liver, where it gets processed by the liver to create, toxic byproducts that then, cause harm in your body. So there are lots of reasons why choosing the fat is going to be a much better choice than choosing the sugar-heavy product.
So, Eve, for your family now that you've reached an equilibrium, how do you think of and conceive of sugar in your diet?
Well, the way I like to characterize it is that our family, we're high-level sugar avoiders at this point. We know where it is. We know where to find it. And most of the time, 99% of the time, we do avoid it. And then every once in a while, there'll be a special occasion. And if we're out at a restaurant, we might order one dessert and the four of us will share it. And that's just perfect because, the first two bites of a dessert are always the best anyway. and then if we're at home and, we'll have a treat, but it's something small and it's special. And that's really what I think sugar is designed for, and I think it's what sugar is best at.
So beyond the way this has been incorporated into your bodies, do you find anything different in the way your family interacts after this experiment?
I think we're a lot closer. It was a big family adventure. It was a project. It was hard. It was easy. It was, fun. It was, everything. And we really came together as a family as a result, I think.
So Eve Schaub says they are high-level sugar avoiders. Rachel Johnson, what do you say to people who are thinking, okay, I still don't know exactly what to do? What's your message for healthful sugar intake for people?
Well, my first thing I say to people is think about what you drink. Stay away from those sugar-sweetened beverages, the number one source of added sugars in our diets. So watch the soft drink, energy drink, sports drinks, fruits drinks. That'd be the first place I would go.
And then go for a really high-fat salad dressing instead of a sugary one. No, okay, maybe that's not quite the right message. Rachel Johnson is a nutrition professor at the University of Vermont. She's also chair of the American Heart Association's Nutrition Committee. Thank you so much for being on the program.
It's a pleasure.
Eve Schaub is the author of Year of No Sugar. We have a link to her book at vpr.net. Eve, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We are still getting emails and Facebook posts from listeners as well, so you can join that conversation. Brian from Jericho says, perhaps it's important to note that not all human bodies are the same. My body changed a lot during my 40s and 50s. I used to have no highs and lows from sugar intake, but now in my 60s, it seems like every drop of sweetener has a big effect on me. So share your thoughts. Go to Vermont Edition's Facebook page. And coming up on the program, a new designation for the Missisquoi National Wildlife Refuge. We'll find out why this wetland is so important to the Lake Champlain ecosystem and what makes it so unique in the United States. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Franklin County in northwestern Vermont is home to an expansive wetland and river delta called the Missisquoi National Wildlife Refuge. The area is a gem in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service portfolio, and now it's received a new distinction. The Missisquoi Delta, Bay, and Wetlands have been named a Wetland of International Importance. Joining us to explain is Ken Sturm, Wildlife Refuge Manager. Ken, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So this new accolade comes from the Ramsar Convention on Wetlands. What is the Ramsar Convention?
Well, let me just back up one second and note that it's not just the refuge that enjoys this new designation, but it's three other state wildlife management areas that surround the Missisquoi National Wildlife Refuge that are included in the designation.
Mm.
So it's a neat kind of state-federal partnership that went in to gain this designation. And so the Ramsar Treaty is an international convention on wetlands that was established in 1971, and it basically encourages countries to conserve and manage wetlands in an ecological context. And if you think about like the history of wetland laws and protection, just in our country alone, I mean, right now we have fairly robust wetland protection standards, but you know, the Clean Water Act didn't pass until 1972 in this country, and the United States didn't join the Ramsar Convention until 1987, which is 1 year past the Emergency Wetland Resources Act of 1986. So even our country has had, you know, a fairly recent history of evolving concepts about wetland conservation and protection. And what this convention does is it reaches a global community to recognize areas that have high ecological significance and tout their protection and conservation.
So for the Missisquoi area, for the Delta Bay and wetlands, this designation, as I understand it, it doesn't change anything about the management of the refuge or what people are allowed to do in the area. But you still think it's an important designation.
That's right. I mean, again, for our designation in this particular case, the lands that we're talking about are already owned either by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or the state. So they already enjoy a high level of protection. The convention doesn't come with any required management laws or stipulations, but just voluntary compliance with the covenants that are established under the convention. So it won't really change what we do or how we do it because we're already managing the wetlands of these areas for their ecological integrity. And it doesn't exclude any kind of public use or anything like that, any different than what the National Wildlife Refuge System and the state permits. So what makes it really neat, I think, is that it really raises the level of awareness on the significance of these wetlands in northern Vermont and Lake Champlain that in a lot of ways sometimes just go, you know, undiscussed in the community and in the environmental and conservation community. And this really puts us in the league with places that are also Ramsar sites in the United States, like the Everglades and San Francisco Bay and Horican Marsh, which are very well-known areas. So I think it creates a parallel and shows that, you know, there is a very, very significant wetland complex in Vermont, and makes the connection between that and other ecologically significant areas across the country and across the globe.
You mentioned a minute ago that the refuge is already being managed for its ecological integrity, and you just said, you know, it's very important to the ecosystem. So can you explain a little bit more about this specific site, why it's so important and what it does?
Yeah, so this is a this little corner of Vermont hosts a lot of really great biological facts. The refuge itself was established to conserve and manage for migratory waterfowl, and we host this site hosts the greatest concentration of waterfowl, upwards of 20,000 birds in the fall, and it's the largest concentration on Lake Champlain at that time. We also have the largest great blue heron rookery in the state of Vermont. We're the only nesting site for state-listed black terns. We have listed spiny softshell turtles that utilize the Missisquoi River, lake sturgeon that use the Missisquoi River. We have at least 5 state-listed mussel species that inhabit the refuge in the Missisquoi River and wetlands. So it basically hosts a lot of rare animals and large concentrations of other animals and other wildlife. The other interesting thing about the Missisquoi Refuge is that it has some really unique plant communities that provide a great biological diversity component to the state's, portfolio of habitats. We have the largest bog in the state of Vermont and probably one of the largest bogs in New England outside of probably Maine. The Mequon Bog, and it hosts a couple rare plants, but also a unique plant community that doesn't occur anywhere else in the state, a wetland pitch pine community.
Well, and the Missisquoi is also, can you explain it? It's a bird's foot delta, so right, and that's right. Pretty rare?
It is. If you look at it from above, it has several branches of active flow, and then a few branches that have since been pinched off in geologic time. And so it instead of having one linear long delta, it has multiple outlets. You know, Missisquoi right now has 3 main outlets, and it's defined as a bird's foot delta. And the only other, I think, really good example of this is the Mississippi River. And so it's a fairly unique geologic feature. But that geologic formation actually contributes and probably is one of the main reasons why we have such extensive wetlands here. You know, these branches create little embayments that, you know, over time have filled in to create great vegetated freshwater marshes. And so we have extensive freshwater marshes associated with the delta.
So, Ken, when people talk about wetlands as a place that you can trap pollutants and keep them out of, say, Lake Champlain in this case, or, you know, a way to manage so that we can continue to develop in other areas, how does that strike you when we're trying to have a balance between maintaining what you called ecological integrity mm-hmm. and development?
Right, and that's exactly what the Ramsar Convention is about, is trying to strike a balance between wetland conservation and what they call wise use or sustainable development in a regional context. Certainly wetlands are always well known and explained to the public on their benefits to people. I mean, they are incredible sponges to slow down storm surges and slowly release water into a watershed rather than flashy flows that create floods and erosion, and they do indeed trap nutrients and sediment and wetland plants, some of which are really good at absorbing things like heavy metals, thereby keeping the greater watershed a little bit cleaner. But at a certain point, you know, there's a tipping point. So water quality is of utmost concern for our refuge because we're at the very terminus of a gigantic watershed. And indeed, we do absorb a lot of pollutants and sediment, but it's also an extremely important nursery for fish, migratory site for birds and nesting locations for a lot of wildlife. So the quality of those habitats in a lot of ways, is driven by things that are completely outside of our control at the refuge.
Well, and it's also a wonderful place to visit, so people should check it out. Ken Sturm is the refuge manager at the Missisquoi National Wildlife Refuge. We've been discussing the refuge's recent inclusion in a designation as a wetland of international importance. Ken, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
The artwork on display this month at the Chaffee Art Gallery in Rutland ranges in style from African masks and ceramic animals to digital art, photography, and acrylic paintings. As VPR's Nina Keck reports, the artworks do have one thing in common, however. All the contributing artists are students.
17-year-old Abby Tamber, a senior at Rutland High School, stands in front of a whimsical painting that looks like it could have been taken from a children's book.
This is a self-portrait of myself. I really love colorful things, and socks especially, as you might notice.
Tamber glances down at the flamboyant socks she's wearing, bright brown and green with funny shapes all over them. She says outrageous socks, poofy skirts, and hair bows are among her favorite fashion statements, and they're all included in her self-portrait.
But I left out the face. A lot of people will point that out because it's trying to show, like, the personality and not the person. But when you see the clothes, you know, people around school who didn't talk to me ever would be like, did you do that? I can tell by the socks.
Tamber's painting is one of 308 original works on display at the Chaffee. Meg Barros, the Chaffee's executive director, says 22 schools, most in Rutland County, provided work from students in kindergarten through 12th grade.
I think on many levels, having the students have the opportunity to display work in a true gallery, it's important for the gallery because it shows that we're embracing artists at all level within our environment. It's important for the students because it increases their sense of pride in the work that they accomplished. And it gives them exposure to so many people who would not have otherwise had the opportunity to come in contact with their creativity. And we inspire each other through our creativity.
The Chaffee is headquartered in a gorgeous 19th century mansion. It's an impressive backdrop for the student art, which is displayed throughout the building on two levels. Barros and several student artists make their way up the dramatic central staircase, stopping to admire a translucent, oversized spider mounted on the banister, digitally enhanced photographs, and other art along the way.
Of course, I love the masks from Otter Valley. It's a series of 12 masks, and these masks are three-dimensional, and these masks have pieces that just pop off the wall at you, literally. And what these students were able to create using basic pieces of colored construction paper, and each mask has its own distinct personality and character.
Barros says there's a growing interest in art that's created from found or recycled objects, and she loved what several high school students did with old cardboard.
And I'm looking at the dining room table in the yellow room, and when the five sculptures that I'm looking at came in from Rutland High School, I immediately knew that I wanted them set at the dining room table.
Students cut up old boxes to create three-dimensional busts, layering the cardboard to form delicate cheekbones, hair, chins, eyes, and mouths.
One of the pieces even has these incredibly involved eyelashes that basically she just sat there and cut like 55 little incisions in a piece of cardboard so she could glue it above the eyeball and create eyelashes. And again, students presented with what to some people might seem like a limitation. You're given a piece of cardboard and told, I want you to create a bust. These students did not see that as a limitation. They just embraced it and took it to its achievable level of creativity.
Have you seen people come up and walk around this exhibit, and what's the reaction?
You know, they stand at the end of the table because I put Lincoln, one bust is of Lincoln, so I put Lincoln at the head of the table. It seemed appropriate. And then it's like Lincoln is having dinner with four teenagers from 2014. That's how I view the whole thing. And that's how many parents look at it. And I've heard more than one parent say, so if you were having dinner with Lincoln, what would you be saying to Abraham? What do you think he'd think about 2014? And it is something to cause you to ponder and wonder. You know,
the display definitely gets people talking, she says. And isn't that what art is supposed to do? Fred Lauer is a fine arts teacher at Rutland High School, and he says Rutland is an incredibly rich area for the arts, with the two Chaffee Galleries, Castleton's Art Galleries, the Carving Studio and West Rutland Art Park for sculpture, and Friday night art hops in the city. He says kids in the area are lucky, and this exhibit just adds to that.
And to have a place that was open to the public, where there's a reception, where I don't know if you were here at the opening here, but this was just packed. I've never seen the Chaffee so crowded. And it's just a wonderful event, and it gives them a chance to, feel good about themselves and show off a little bit.
Tala Caruso, a 17-year-old senior from Rutland High School, stands near the painting she has on display. She says for her, art is very personal, a relaxing, hands-on process that allows her to express herself.
There's a reward when you create something and then you can step back and, look at it and say, oh, I made that. And, especially having it here in the gallery where other people can appreciate, that you made something and that they can see, the work that you did. It's very rewarding.
Caruso's painting and the rest of the Chaffee's student art exhibit will be on display until the end of the month. For VPR News, I'm Nina Keck in Rutland.
And you can see photos of some of the student artwork on display on our website, vpr.net. That's it for today. Tomorrow, we'll learn about what our amphibians and reptiles are up to and when you'll start to hear their distinctive calls. Maybe you already are. We'd love to know what you've been seeing dart under your tires or hop through your yard. Let us know at vermontedition@vpr.net. Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing are our producers. We have assistance from Tim Johnson and Devin Karambalis. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.